talking about building walls and fences and turning in on ourselves.
Asad Rehman, this is part one of our conversation. Come back tomorrow for part two. That's Asad Rehman, spokesperson for Friends of the Earth International. Quick correction to our headline on the mistrial of former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing. He shot Sam Dubose in the head, killing him, not in the back. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Meen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottes, Dino, Dina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chirina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 8 o'clock. More Talk Radio is up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Chuck Collins, speaking Tuesday, November 15th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel in Portland. Chuck Collins is the author of Born on Third Base, a one-percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. He'll be talking about the people's movement of disadvantaged communities and communities of color's need to engage with the 1% community and the 1%'s need to step up and get involved. Again, that's Chuck Collins speaking Tuesday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel, at 1211 Southwest Main Street here in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Community Advisory Board will meet on Tuesday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. My name is Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday, November 17th?
14th.
Oh, okay. I'm getting ahead of myself. and we're glad that you are here. Let me give you our phone numbers. You may want to call in later on and talk with our guests. Our phone numbers here are 503-231-8187. So it certainly has been quite a week. We are going to do a little shift here in terms of talking about our social and political life by looking back to look forward. Joining us this morning is a film producer, writer, and lecturer on many topics, Cynthia Lucas. Together with director Cal Kern, she has created a nonprofit educational media organization, Heaven on Earth Creation, and has co-produced widely acclaimed documentaries about global oneness and nonviolence, including PBS biography on the Sufi poet Rumi, and Uplift and Film about the emergent Global Consciousness entitled Globalized Soul, and the focus of our conversation this morning, Gandhi's Gift. It is a powerful film which examined the last years of Gandhi's life, and including very great interviews with people familiar with Gandhi and his work. We have the privilege of viewing the film here, those of us who are here in Portland, this evening at PCC Cascade Campus and at 7 p.m. Thank you, Michael. Also joining us is Michael Sunleitner, who is a Gandhi scholar. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning.
Now, for those of you who were, you know, not here physically, we were in a panic merely moments ago. So the fact that we are all here in this studio is a testimony that things are going to go well. So we are broadcasting, we are on the air. And thank you, Cynthia, for joining us.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And Michael.
Hello.
Okay, he speaks. But, you know, a lot of people in this country, and I imagine throughout the world, are excited about the, you know, U.S. elections. And I thought it was very wise for just the planets to line just in order. When I get a call from Michael, because I hadn't seen the email he sent me a while ago, about you coming and about this film. So tell us a little bit about the subject matter of this film and how it came to be.
Well, Gandhi's Gift, as you mentioned in the introduction, explores the final years of Gandhi's life. And in it, we ask the question, were Gandhi's final years his finest? We document his final 4 years, which 1944 to 1948, when he's assassinated. And those are extremely dramatic and profound years in the life of the master of nonviolence, if I can call him that. And it shows him coming out of prison in his 70s and having just lost his wife of more than 60 years, lost his closest work colleague of more than 25 years, and coming out of prison with many diseases, almost dead. In fact, that's why the British released him from prison, is because they thought he was going to die. They didn't want him to die in prison. And he had been put in prison for launching the largest nonviolent protest demonstration campaign ever in history, and that was Quit India. And he was in prison for 21 months. So he comes out and he's in his 70s. He's at a low point in his life. He's almost in despair because forces have taken hold of his country to the extent where the partition of India is about to occur. And he had described the partition of India as a vivisection of his own body. He did not want the partition to take place, but politicians on many sides were in the process of making that happen when he came out of prison. So he was actually rejected by his own closest colleagues in politics. And so at this low point, what does he do? And that's what you'll see in this film. In his 70s, he does amazing things in his late 70s. And primarily, if I can describe them, I don't want to, you know, give a spoiler alert about everything that's in the film, but primarily he shows the world how to create peace in the darkest of times, and that is through grassroots peacemaking that he does. I'll give one example, which in many ways to me is the culmination of his life's work. He decides to go on a pilgrimage at the age of 76 and 77 to villages where Hindus and Muslims have been slaughtering each other. And he decides that he will take his 70-plus-year-old body and walk barefoot from village to village and walk up to the people and ask them to live together and make an emotional face-to-face plea with them to unify and stop killing each other. It's a very dangerous situation he puts himself in, but he faces the violence with his own nonviolence in his heart. And as King and others will do later, he really gets their resistance to melt, and they stop the killing. So this is a man in his 70s who's showing really the world. At the time, he's showing his fellow Indians, but this will, you know, people will take up this kind of nonviolent strategy later in the world, just showing us what to do in the darkest of times when maybe you feel like you don't have a lot of power on the global stage, but you take it to the grassroots level, and that's where you will make the changes that are necessary in the world that will ripple outward and make the ultimate positive changes that you want to happen. And so that's just one of the scenes in the film. So
so we're speaking with Cynthia Lucas, who's a co-producer of Gandhi's Gift, which will be shown at Portland Community College Cascade Campus this evening at 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock.
Seven to nine.
And I thought we might think about not getting ahead of ourselves. We threw out Gandhi. You mentioned last campaign, and maybe we need to step back a bit in terms of who was this man, what is his relevance, and
how do we make a connection?
Yeah. So, and Michael, please feel free to jump in terms of describing the man, his philosophy, his evolution. But who was he?
Well, we were talking about this over breakfast, Cynthia and I. 7 years ago, was on a Fulbright grant into India, teaching Gandhian philosophy at another
in
place
India.
In India.
Oh.
Yeah,
that had to have been a quintessential experience then.
Well, I'm not sure about quint, but it was.
It was essential, huh?
It was essential for me. And I would oftentimes, because I'm an odd person anyway, generally, but when it comes to a Gandhi scholar who is a white male in India, I was in demand as a speaker and oftentimes looked at with suspicion. And that's understandable. Mm-hmm. My suspicious audiences oftentimes would be very critical of Gandhi and also not very well informed about his philosophy. I found myself raising the basic question in relevance. How's he relevant? How's he relevant today? In India? In anywhere? And I would say, well, do you believe in karma? Do you believe in not just the concept, but the reality of karma, that we tend to reap what we sow? A kind of a foundational metaphysical assumption. And whether you assume it or not, I'm going to say, from my point of view, it's real. We reap what we sow. As Malcolm X once said, the chickens come home to roost. It's not just individuals reaping, it's society's reaping, it's the global society that reaps what is sown in China or anywhere else in the world. And that is Gandhi's relevance. Fundamentally, he believed that nonviolence was the only means by which to achieve higher understanding of truth in any situation. That the means become the end. It's not that the end justifies the means. It's the means justify the end. You can't get an apple tree if you plant an avocado seed. You can't get democracy if you plant dictatorship. It's a fundamental concept that is timeless, which Gandhi manifested his time, but because it is timeless, continues to be relevant today.
You know, I might add, in terms of just describing who Gandhi was, in just a few words, a nonviolent general. I think he saw himself as that, and marshaling the nonviolent forces to oppose oppression, injustice, inequality, all of those kinds of values that he believed nonviolence was the truth of the universe. The highest truth that one can strive for is to be absolutely nonviolent and to attain nonviolence. So when we ask who he is, I think Michael explained it very well, coming down to karma. You are nonviolent because if you are violent, and by being violent, it's not just hitting someone or killing someone, but it's also thinking ill of someone, judging them harshly, saying nasty things, thinking nasty things, you know, all of these things that are essentially violent toward another human being. And this was a very deep-seated spiritual foundation that he had, this belief in nonviolence. And he was continually striving to be absolutely nonviolent in his own person, because he knew that he couldn't be nonviolent to others unless he was nonviolent within. So he had to align his inner self with the person that he would show the world. And so he's famously known for that line, "My life is my message," which he told to some young students late in his life. They wanted a message from him. And he said, you know, "My life is my message." He's essentially saying, don't listen to my words. Look at what I've done. Look at what I'm doing. And so he's constantly in his life modeling this nonviolence that we've been talking about for others to see, and he hoped would adopt, you know, that kind of philosophy and way of relating to the world and to others.
You mentioned earlier in terms of his final years, and a key to it was his grassroots organizing. For some of us who are unfamiliar with Gandhi, other than the idea that he was an older man who was probably very nice.
and wore glasses.
And wore glasses. And wasn't Ben Kingsley.
Not Ben Kingsley. Okay.
But in terms of grassroots organizing, how does that knit into the whole philosophy of nonviolence, and say something about what type of campaigns did he organize?
Well, the grassroots work that he did in terms of nonviolence is, let me use that example that I just did, where he went into villages and where there had been killing, interreligious killing between Hindus and Muslims. And he took his body and sort of put it in front of these people who'd been killing each other, and just went up to them and in his nonviolent way of loving both the victim and the victimizer, if I can use those words, he believed that he could heal the situation. He believed that nonviolence, true love, if you want to take it and describe it that way, will heal any situation because of its power, that's the power of love and nonviolence. And so he took belief and truth into those villages, and on a grassroots level, took it person to person and saw them healed in village to village. And so that's the way he did that answer your question? Mm-hmm. How he was using that in his grassroots level? And it's a absolute firm belief in nonviolence and the ability to heal a situation, to bring people together, that when you're absolutely pure in your heart with nonviolence and love, opposition to you and to others will melt. He sort of used that term, melt. It just dissolves because love is so powerful. It is the absolutely most powerful force in the universe. And when people who are in conflict, hating, you know, being violent, are faced with that, that in, you know, many cases, if not all, their opposition will melt when they come face to face with someone with that power. And so it's the power of love. It's the power of nonviolence that he took on a grassroots level. And he believed that that is where change occurs. You make those changes on the local level. And his whole idea of the universe was in concentric circles made up of people. They're all equal, not a pyramid. He never talked about societies being a pyramid with the, you know, the power at the top and the people on the bottom supporting those higher ups. He talked about concentric circles, everybody being equal, and that's these villages. And so if you create peace in this village and then that village and then this village, it radiates outward and creates a whole peaceful society. So it's done on the grassroots level, and it starts. It never comes from the top down. It comes, peace and this kind of radical change comes from the bottom up. Or if you will, in these circles, and radiates outward.
I think one thing that may be a bit of a challenge for those of us in the Western Hemisphere to really grasp that is the fact that when you talk about love and you talk about human beings trying to connect with each other, we understand being kind to each other in an abstract way sometimes. Uh-huh. When you talk about campaigns or when you talk about organizing or connecting. But when you're talking about an elderly man who has undergone torture and deprivation and isolation, coming into his own country that's, as you very aptly put, is being severed, is being cut up into pieces. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to appeal to sectarian groups.
Uh-huh.
What is the connection? How do you as one human being who does not necessarily embody both of those cultures make that connection, I think, is what I'm looking at and hearing, because I know how hard it has been for, and I'm giving air quotes, Americans to come together just with a red ideology and a blue ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have your Hindu and your Muslims. Did he come to them and say, we are one, despite mm-hmm. having a faith that may not have analogous words or ideas or concepts for love or for community, or maybe have antagonistic ideas for love and community? And actually, that's going to go to both of you.
Well, I'll start.
I think
Gandhi would say, we are connected with one another and we are not. We are both and. He's not an either-or dualistic person.
And that's what makes it hard for a lot of Americans.
And
with
so,
that.
So Gandhi would say, I am a Muslim, a Hindu, a Christian, and a Jew.
I am you.
I am you.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I am not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he doesn't claim to be African-American.
Every man. Right.
But he wants to be. He actually seeks to be in himself a universal person. That's an incredibly radical individual goal. That's part of what he sees as perfect nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are the commonalities that all of these disparate groups have?
Well, we're human.
We're human.
We breathe.
We breathe.
We eat, we love, we die.
And also, we can relate to
mm-hmm.
the idea of the categorical imperative, which is, of course, Kant. Mm-hmm. But that you should so live as you would have the entire world live. You do not live on more than your fair share of the planet.
You, now, that right there is a radical
incredible
thought for Americans.
Now that,
yeah,
the
our
golden,
culture
it's
is totally
the golden
antithetical
rule.
To living that
rule.
Way.
It's the golden
yes.
rule.
It's the golden rule. And so, you know, he never called himself an environmentalist, but he was ridiculously extreme environmentalist. He would not discard a pencil until it literally was too small to write with. I mean, that's just a silly example, but he would always recycle. He would always live with the planet. Never consume more than is your fair share, and certainly do not consume so much as to harm future generations. He takes on someone like Winona the Duke's idea of looking seven generations into the future.
Mm-hmm.
It comes back to karma. There are going to be ripples into the future of what you do or don't do in your life.
And don't do is just as important because,
absolutely.
It is. You know, if you do not do the kindness that is required, well, that's just as bad as doing harm. So when we talk about recognizing that we should not take more than is rightfully ours, how would you translate that for today's United States citizen to grasp and recognize there's a certain part of both grasping for positive change and letting go of whatever ire there is with not just the political system we have, but the way the 1% tries to keep structuring our life to tell us that we need more?
Well, you know, one of Gandhi's sayings, too, is the world has enough for everyone's need and not enough for everyone's greed. And, you know, it is a somewhat of a foreign concept to America and perhaps, if I can say, the West. You know, this whole idea of I'm going to take what's mine, you know, what the Bhagavad Gita says, the ego cage of I, me, mine, you know, and that was a echo of George Harrison song, by the way, I, me, me, mine. And it is a radical shift in thinking. I come back to the fact that it really has, a lot of his philosophy has as its basis that everyone is absolutely equal. Everyone is absolutely, the same. If you want to say they're divine, each person is a child of God, or however you want to think about it, everyone is equal and has the same worth. And I think that a lot of our work here in the United States has to come back to that, has to come back to that basic principle. I think some of us felt there was motion forward in that direction, and then maybe now there's, you know, or maybe we're just seeing some of the underbelly that always existed. But anyway, I think that is a part of our challenge is to continue to teach that message. And to me, it's absolutely fundamental with Gandhi. The people that we interviewed for Gandhi's Gift, for example, and some of them won't even be in the film, but we interviewed, you know, 35 different people who, some of which actually knew him. And all of them said the same. A woman who grew up in his ashram, a man who is still in his Sevagram ashram in his 90s who knew him. But everybody who we interviewed who knew him said the same thing. He treated everyone absolutely equal. Whether it was a child, whether it was the prime minister, whether it was, you know, somebody of this religion, that religion, you know, whatever, this country, that country. He loved the British, even though you asked earlier about what were his campaigns. His primary campaigns in India were to overthrow the British rule in India. But he taught his students and followers to love the British, even though they were trying to eject them from the country. And his one of his largest campaigns that put him into prison there at the end of his life was Quit India. Earlier, it was the Salt March that he had led that was so large. But he always taught, don't hate the British, even though they are oppressing us and they're, you know, they've sucked out all our resources. And that was what the Salt March was about, you know, them illegally picking up salt, which that was a blow against the British Empire. But anyway, he said, don't hate the British. You can't hate the oppressor, or if you want to call him your opponent, or whatever you want to call that other person. Try not to think of him as an enemy. You know, think of him as somebody who you have an opportunity to change his or her heart. And that's the way you go forward to change somebody's mind, is you change their heart.
Absolutely.
So we're speaking this morning with Cynthia Lucas, a producer of the film Gandhi's Gift, which will be shown this evening, Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and also with Dr. Michael Sunleitner, who is a Gandhi scholar. The film is subtitled The Tragedy and Triumph of the Final Years. And earlier, Cynthia, you mentioned Gandhi coming out of prison. And I imagine towards the... You see a vision you've worked on for many years, and it's almost there. And from what I gather from you, it's sort of like it's almost falling apart. The land is being divided between, you know, two major religious groups and ethnic tensions. What was triumphant about his final years, as well as what was tragic?
Well, I think the tragedy came with the losses that he felt, his own personal losses, but also this major heartbreaker, really, of the partition of India that he was so opposed to. He's always about unifying, never about dividing. So I think that was probably the greatest tragedy. And with the partition came this terrible, horrific violence, and that's what broke his heart even more. So, facing that kind of tragedy, I think his triumph was in just rallying to do the work that he did for unification in this terrible situation of the partition of India. And people were leaving their homes. They had to leave their homes to move. Mm. And so there were people being slaughtered on trains. There were... They believed during the partition, it's called the Great Killing, that up to 2 million people were killed. So, wow. And it was the greatest mass migration of people ever in history. So it was vast. It was enormous violence. And this just broke his heart, because he had been teaching nonviolence his entire life. And then to see his own people who during earlier campaigns had been with him, you know, and largely been nonviolent, to see them turn to violence like that just really broke his heart more than anything. And in his last years, he made statements like, I pray to God, you know, to help me overcome, help my people overcome this violence, or I don't want another birthday. You know, I mean, he was ready to go. His heart was so broken. But his triumph is in the fact that he's still able... I gave the example of going into those villages and stopping the killing there. He also, that's called the miracle of Noah Kali. People literally call it a miracle. He also fasts in Calcutta. That has been called the miracle of Calcutta, when he does a fast and stops the violence there. He then has a final, he goes to Delhi and has a final fast that stops the interreligious killing there. So these are called miracles by people who witness them, because they see this horrific violence going on, and then they see this man walking in the midst of him, and you know, he's able to get people to stop and to stop hating. And, of course, his assassination in 1948 stopped the killing for maybe 40 or 50 years as well. And he knew that. He knew that was coming. James Douglas, an author and activist, Gandhi in the film, talks about that very thing, that a prophet, any prophet, particularly of nonviolence, knows that he will be assassinated at some point. He just doesn't know when. And that's exactly what occurred, of course, with Gandhi. And Douglas makes some great parallels between Gandhi and Jesus Christ, which people in the United States and in the West will be able to really relate to those correlations that are made between those two figures, such as, you know, Gandhi actually says at the end of his life, just as Jesus on the cross asked for forgiveness for his assassins, his killers, I'm asking God to give me the forgiveness to forgive my assassins. He knew they were coming. He knew it. He didn't stop it. He had interfaith prayer meetings twice a day, every day for most of his life. And at the end, the security wanted to take, you know, to have somebody at the gates of these, you know, interfaith prayer meetings where thousands would come. And they wanted to check them for weapons and so forth. Gandhi refused. He refused to have those kinds of security checks. He said, if my people want to kill me, if they don't think my life is worth anything right now, you know, I open myself up to that. So, anyway, amazing man with a message, I think, for us today.
Well, you know, we do have a couple of callers, but I do want to put a bookmark on something that you said earlier, Cecil, and that was about the echoes, you know, the echoes of the past and being so relevant to the present right now. Everything from the mass migration of people having to leave their country because of sectarian violence to really divisive politics. And one of the things that I think is really important has come out of this, and it, you know, I wish people would pay a little bit more attention, and that is the fact that we're talking about a country that was sacked by the British for its resources to help the British Empire stay number one, and it's a lot of that very, very greedy and what is the word I want? Primary. It's like I have to be on top. I am the top of the heap, so to speak, mentality that Americans have, I think, that have made us fall prey to the very divisive campaign we've had. We don't have a right to the world's resources.
Yes, that's
you
right.
You know, and
that's right.
We seem to think that America being great means we must subjugate all the rest of the countries. And, you know, I could see Gandhi today saying, shame on you.
Yes,
you know,
I can too.
Nothing much more than that, but a simple shame on you. What makes you think that the world owes you this? What have you given the world? But before we really unpack that, I'm going to go to our callers. Good morning, Mike. You're on air.
Hi, thanks. I don't mean to be negative or anything. I just have a question really quick about Gandhi and his thoughts on segregation between Indians and Africans. I read something like in 1831.
Mike, are you outside?
I am actually.
Can you cover up your you know, like cup your receiver?
Can you hear me better now?
Yes. Can you repeat what you said?
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about Gandhi's belief on segregation, and I had read that in 1831 he felt that Indians and Africans should be segregated. Not to be negative or anything like that about the greatness that, you know, he accomplished, but what your thoughts were on that.
Thank you.
Well, first, you're probably thinking in terms of Gandhi in South Africa, I'm guessing. And that began in 1895. He was there for 20 years till 1915.
Okay.
His view there was the Asiatic Law Amendment Ordinance, which was a white-dominated culture's discrimination against Indians in South Africa, mm-hmm. needed to be fought by Indians. He didn't believe in segregation. He did believe that a women's movement should be led by women. That a movement for liberation of Asian people against white rule in South Africa should be led by Asians.
Mm-hmm.
He was not indifferent to the discrimination placed by that same white Afrikaner government to the African populations of South Africa. But that was not his battle. He was willing to be an ally to any movement that would come from that community. And he was willing to accept support from black Africans as well as sympathetic white people for his movement.
Do you mind if I read you something really quick? I'm not trying to be a negative person.
Well, no, it's good. Thank you for bringing it.
It's confusing mm-hmm. to me because this is something that do you mind if I read something to you?
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It said, in 1893, Gandhi wrote to the National Parliament saying that the general belief seems to prevail in the colony that the Indians are a little better, if at all, than the savages of the native Africa.
Well, I'd like to actually see that, but let's assume that the quote is correct. And he might have,
let's just assume that. From the BBC.com, just to let you know.
Well, BBC, an aired taped interview. In any case, let's assume that it's correct. Gandhi may have used the word savages in 1893. It's possible he did.
Uh-huh.
He was, in many ways, a human being who reflected some of the language of his time. You could also argue that he was very patriarchal in his language. A lot of things you could point out. And that was something that would change. Certainly, he wasn't even in South Africa yet in 1893.
Okay.
And his attitudes did change remarkably in interaction with human beings.
Yeah.
You need
I totally understand.
But you have to.
I was confused. I was confused about it because I didn't know much about his life. So.
We don't understand that Gandhi moves from truth to truth. He's a truth seeker, not a truth haver. Mm-hmm. And so at one point, he would also say, I believe in the caste system.
Yeah.
Later, he would say, I will only preside at weddings between intercaste marriages. He was a loyal citizen of the British Empire until 1919. After that, he became a revolutionary. His truths change.
Yeah, just like any person, yeah.
And his language changes, but his fundamental philosophy, after about 1908, is steadfastly consistent. You seek truth through nonviolence with the willingness to sacrifice and voluntarily suffer.
Thank you, Mike.
Awesome. Thank you.
Could I just add one thing? His foundational work was very important for the evolution of South Africa against, apartheid, because when he left to India, one of his sons stayed there and continued the sort of Gandhian work. And then we interviewed the daughter of that son, Manilal, Ela Gandhi, who is still in South Africa and has been an activist for a number of causes and was, one of the first to meet Mandela after he was released from prison. And so she was a colleague of his. So Gandhi believed that South Africans should fight their own, fight, a nonviolent fight for against apartheid, but his being there, I think, laid some foundational basis for, that movement to move forward. In terms of him standing up for the equality of Indians, I think helped, that later movement for South Africans to take control of their own, you know, country. So he's had a profound impact there. And his granddaughter, Ela, said that two things, you know, could directly be pointed to Gandhian nonviolence in South Africa. When their first constitution was made, they outlawed the beating of children in schools because that used to occur a lot, she said. And she thought that was a result of her grandfather, Gandhi. And she also said that the outlawing of capital punishment, she felt, was a direct result of Gandhi's foundational work in that country.
You know, one of the things I think is really important is we talk about a person's growth and development. We're talking about a man who grew up as a loyal citizen to the British Empire, which is one of the most racist establishments at that time. And he was also an upper-class person, educated person, and so much, as you have said, a product of his times. And so the fact that he has made that 180-degree shift, I think, is what we need to focus on, because we're talking about the travel from hatred to love, you know, from division to unity, all of these dynamics that demonstrate growth and love. And so we're not talking about somebody who's perfect. We're talking about somebody who has demonstrated that we all have that capacity to change. What did he say? You know, I am, you know, my life is my work. And so I think it's really important. And yes, there's a couple of new books out even. One of them is The South African Gandhi, The Stretcher Bearer of the Empire. And mm-hmm. that is written by two South Africans. And while I think they are trying to perhaps put a little dust on his glow, I think what they do is they still demonstrate that this is a human being who evolved. I mean, we look at Malcolm X's evolution. We look mm-hmm. at a lot of people's evolution, and we laud them for that.
Yeah.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Our guests this morning are Cynthia Lucas, producer of the film Gandhi's Gift, which will be shown this evening, Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at Portland Community College Cascade Campus.
That's a mouthful.
And Michael Sunleitner, a former professor and Gandhian scholar.
Yeah.
Let's go to Frances.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, yes, you're here.
Hi. I appreciate your conversation this morning. And I was just thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King's teachings and writings, you know, his letters from Birmingham Jail and some of his other writings on agape love, and how he promoted the whole philosophy of love that Gandhi gave us. And I myself feel that that's what we need right now very much, as far as loving the oppressors. What I wanted to say, though, I'm just going to listen to your guys' discussion. But Dr. Sunleitner, did you used to teach at Portland Community College?
For 27 years, full time.
Thank you. I want to let you know, personally, I never thought I'd get to speak to you, that my young son, Sabian, when he began to re-enter and start his higher education, would quote you so many times to me in our discussions of the world and everything that's going on in the world. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate how you inspired him and how you validated his thoughts. I'm very happy to just speak to you right now, because I don't know how many times he's quoted you, but it's pretty nice.
That's very kind of you. You can get my phone number and contact information from Cecil here if you like, and I'd love to visit with you and your son. I'll treat you to a piece of pie sometime if you like.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'll continue to listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Could I add something about the evolution of Gandhi? You know, he said many times, listen to the latest things I've said and what yes. I'm doing now, mm-hmm. you know, because as Dr. Sunlightler was talking about, you know, there was this very pronounced evolution. And what's really going to be interesting is we've been asked, this Gandhi's Gift will be shown on PBS broadcast next year in 2017. And they were so thrilled with this film, PBS asked us to do another hour, actually two more hours, but the next one will be the prequel of this one called Gandhi's Awakening, and it will almost entirely take place in South Africa. So we are going to explore this whole evolution of his that occurs when he comes into South Africa as a staunch British citizen. And guess what? One of the first things that happens is he's thrown off a train because he has the nerve to be seated next to a white person on the train. So that starts his whole evolution. But it doesn't happen overnight. And he's not perfect ever, he would say, but he keeps evolving and evolving. And we're going to explore that, too. You know, how he hits the shores of South Africa, and he's this very patriarchal husband with his wife, and that, too, will evolve. And he will come to see her as an equal and as a great teacher to him of nonviolence. So,
well, especially if she's dealing with a patriarchal society.
That's
and
right.
I really think that it's important for people to recognize how someone's eyes are open and how he gained the tools and the spiritual gravitas to be able to make these moves. Because I keep thinking of where he is in his final years and probably feeling that this life has been a tragedy. But I don't think people realize sometimes it's that very last moments when you have acquired all of this that you actually have the tools to deal with serious issues. And his life was a challenge, but it made him all the more suitable.
Yeah.
So as we, you know, continue our conversation about Gandhi's and his relevance, I want you to share a little bit about, you know, we throw around the word love and nonviolence. And maybe we need to define them as Gandhi thought they were, because I'm not sure we have the same understanding. Nonviolence usually means for many people passivity, inability to respond. And love might mean forgetting the wrongs that people do to you.
So, okay. You want to do that?
All right. This is complex.
Yeah.
Because we've already heard Martin Luther King in his view. Oftentimes he would use a similar language to Gandhi, but sometimes mean different things. I think Martin Luther King, and I'm a scholar of Martin Luther King also, that's part of my doctoral dissertation, saw nonviolence and violence as either or. Either or. You're either violent or nonviolent. You're either right or wrong, either good or bad. Mm. And for King, he would clarify nonviolence as being a very assertive force, powerful nonviolence, as opposed to passivity. Gandhi was much more complicated, much more Eastern. He sees us all as being both violent and nonviolent at the same time. Perfect nonviolence can be achieved only at the point of death for Gandhi. If on the cross, if you will, you forgive those who kill you. At the moment you die, when your breath leaves, your soul leaves your body, if you can do that with an attitude of complete compassion, even for the person who kills you, you can achieve perfect nonviolence. Until then, he would say, stop being so self-righteous. We're all human beings. We're all short of perfection. So choose and draw your lines. He would say you need to, for self-respect, have some boundaries. Gandhi would often be misunderstood by saying, it is better to be a terrorist than to do nothing. And that is because for Gandhi, the terrorist who intentionally harms other human beings and potentially kills innocent people for the sake of a cause, still has the courage to die themselves. And Gandhi praises that courage. He sees inactivity as often born of cowardice. And for Gandhi, cowardice is the absolute worst violence. It destroys yourself, your sense of self-respect. And so Gandhi would and did say, it's better to be a terrorist than to be a coward. It's better to be a regular soldier who has further limits than to be a terrorist. It's better to be a nonviolent soldier and be unwilling to harm your opponent intentionally than to be a regular soldier. And ultimately, he does move towards what he hopes is a more perfect nonviolent soul force, which has, he believed, the capacity even to protect a Daniel in a den of hungry lions. Mm-hmm. So the lions would not even think to do harm. But he wouldn't preach Daniel nonviolence for everyone. That would be silly because they wouldn't relate to it. He would encourage people to go step by step up the ladder. From a coward, well, if you're talking about burning buildings, then burn buildings. Don't talk about it. Oh, well, by the way, there's a better thing than burning buildings. You can peacefully demonstrate nonviolent civil disobedience. He would push people up the line towards what he hoped to be a progressively greater nonviolence.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make one comment about King, since Dr. Sunlightner mentioned him, is in our film Gandhi's Gift, we have a very, very fascinating sequence when Gandhi goes into those villages that I described earlier in Noakhali, Bengal. He is visited by a member of the African American community from the United States, Nelson, who is coming over to find out, you know, about this nonviolent strategy of Gandhi's. And in fact, he will take back that idea and those concepts and strategies to the United States for the civil rights movement. So we're sort of seeing in the history of that movement in the 30s and 40s, the African American leaders saying, we need a Gandhi. Now, he does not arise yet, but later on, King will arise to and I'm not saying that he's exactly like Gandhi either. That's already been pointed out. But somebody like Gandhi does arise in that movement to carry forward the nonviolent strategies in his own way, because he is different, but also similar in some ways. So it's a fascinating parallel, those movements of India, the United States. And Gandhi talks about how the United States needs to take care of that, you know, situation, that inequality of the African American. So he's very aware of his sort of giving, sort of teaching that those early civil rights leaders, and hoping that they will take it to the United States and be successful, which of course they were very, very successful.
We are running short on time. Let's see if we can catch this one caller, and you have about 45 seconds, Rick. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, I want to, so first, thanks for the beautiful discussion. I just wanted to recommend a book that dovetails with this. It's called This Is an Uprising, about how nonviolent revolt is shaping the 21st century. I urge readers to check that book out. And in that book, there's a description of Gandhi's Salt March, mm-hmm. the Great Salt March, and why it was so successful. I wanted to just briefly discuss that, because I'm part of a number of social justice, climate justice movements here in Portland, and I think we can learn something from that. And people thought he was crazy because he picked this very mundane topic, target, that he completely missed the point. He underestimated the impact. They underestimated the impact. And the reason they did is because Gandhi picked a resource. It was morally indefensible for the British to deny access to that natural resource, salt. We have the same issues here at Standing Rock. We have the same issues here for renewable resources, the resource of water. the resource of clean air. This is the moral high ground I think we need to take, and this is the lesson we need to take from Gandhi.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
This evening at 7 p.m. at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus, please come out if you are able to see Gandhi's Gift, The Tragedy and Triumph of the Final
Moriarty.
Oh, yes, I just assumed.
Moriarty.
Moriarty Art and Humanity Building at 7 p.m. Thank you, Cynthia Lucas.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Sunlightman.
Thank you.
And thank you, KBOO supporters and listeners. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 8:59. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's social and political commentary from the Old Mole Variety Hour next. Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia at 10. At 10:15, Locus Focus host Barbara Bernstein talks with longtime human rights activist Kathleen Sadat about how we confront misogyny, racism, and thuggery now that we're living in Trump land. At 11 o'clock on Health Watch, it's a conversation with Dr. Robin Chutkan about digestive health and the microbiome. How we can heal our bodies from the inside out. At 11:30 on Radio Zine, it's Building Bridges. We'll mourn, then we'll analyze, and then we'll organize an election post-mortem. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winona LaDuke, speaking Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Winona LaDuke will speak on nature's historic position as property and the international call to legally recognize nature's right to exist, persist, and naturally evolve. This global movement is dedicated to normalizing the notion of rights of nature. Again, that's Winona LaDuke speaking on the rights of nature, Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom on the corner of 19th Avenue and University Street in Eugene. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root it.